Welcome to this presentation on the basic contents of Islam, focusing on modern issues for the classroom, written by Dr. Asma Afsaruddin. Dr. Afsaruddin is professor in the Department of Near Eastern Languages and Cultures at Indiana University in Bloomington. She's the author of the 2002 book, Excellence and Precedence, Medieval Islamic Discourse on Legitimate Leadership, and, in 2008, of The First Muslims, History and Memory. In addition to her special interest in the Quran and Hadith in Islam, her research interests include political thought in Islam, gender roles, and attitudes toward other religions in Islam. CSEE asked Professor Afsaruddin to share this presentation with us after her tremendous reception at our 2009 Institute on Teaching the World's Religions, where participants found her presentations on jihad and on modern issues in Islam extremely helpful. Here is a narration of Dr. Asma Afsaruddin's presentation. Chapter 1. Dignity of the Human Person. Islam, like other global religions, is a complex, multi-layered, and diverse phenomenon. It is not a static, frozen tradition, but a dynamic, living, and evolving tradition shaped by the needs and responses of its practitioners, the Muslims. Like Christianity and Judaism in particular, Islam has its core beliefs and truth claims, which define Islam, and about which all observant Muslims are in agreement. This would include the five pillars of Islam, which refer first of all to the requirement of a Muslim to believe in the one universal God of history, who revealed his message to Moses, Jesus, and Muhammad, among other prophets known from the Bible and the Quran. Secondly, Muslims are required to pray, either individually or communally, five times a day. Thirdly, to give a percentage of their surplus income to the poor and needy. Fourthly, to fast from dawn till dusk during the month of Ramadan. And finally, if financially and physically able, to perform the pilgrimage to Mecca at least once in one's lifetime. The pilgrimage culminates in a festival known as Eid al-Adha in Arabic, which translates as Festival of the Sacrifice, which commemorates Abraham's offering of his son, Ishmael, in the Muslim tradition in sacrifice to God, but who was then miraculously saved at the last minute. Abraham, of course, is the common forefather of the world's three monotheistic religions. There is a strong emphasis within Islam on social ethics, as, for example, in Christianity. Personal piety and righteousness, after all, are best realized in a social context. In other words, a personal belief in God and love for Him must, of necessity, also become translated into moral and ethical behavior towards all His creation. The departure point of social ethics in Islam, and I would assume in all major faith traditions, is respect for the inherent dignity and sanctity of the human person. The Quran clearly points to the exalted status of humans above all creation. Chapter 17, verse 70 states, "Indeed, we have honored the children of Adam, provided them with transport on land and sea, given them for sustenance things good and pure, and conferred on them special favors above a great part of our creation." End of quote. God further states in the Quran that He gave human beings the best shape and form, and that He had breathed His spirit into the first human, Adam, and through him all humans. It is indeed this divine spark in all of us which makes us naturally inclined to be and to do good. The Quran calls it fitra in Arabic, our inborn disposition to turn towards our Creator, and through him towards our fellow human beings. One may see in these Quranic concepts parallels with the biblical conceptions of humans having been made in God's image, which confers on them a special status. The Quran also tells us that God taught Adam the names of all things, a privilege not extended to any other form of creation, and that He made Adam and his offspring His vice-regent or representative on earth, a point I will come back to later. God further created the heaven and earth and all that is in them for the sake of human beings. It is also for the sake of human beings that he sent his prophets and his guidance through time. Such divine concern for the welfare of human beings points to our exalted status before him, our inherent dignity, and above all, our equality before him. Islam, in fact, strongly asserts the equality of all human beings before God, regardless of gender, socioeconomic status, and ethnicity or race. The only superiority recognized is moral superiority based on belief and righteous conduct. Thus the Quran addresses us, and I quote, O humankind, we have created you from a male and a female, and made you into nations and tribes that you may know one another. Indeed, the most honorable of you before God is the believer who possesses piety. Indeed, God is all-knowing, all-aware. End of quote. The equality of all humans was further stressed by the Prophet Muhammad in a hadith. A hadith in Arabic refers to a specific statement attributed to the Prophet. And in this hadith he said, All of you are from Adam, and Adam was made from clay. No Arab is to be regarded better than a non-Arab, a white person better than a black, or vice versa, except in regard to piety. End of quote. The theme of the oneness of humankind is repeated in the Quran in different ways. We are told that all human beings have been created of a single soul. This is from chapter 4, verse 1. And that all humans are descended from the same parents. Chapter 49, verse 13. All the children of Adam are honorable. Chapter 17, verse 70. And they were as it were dwellers in one home, having the same earth as a resting place and the same heaven as a canopy. At the same time, the Quran also recognizes and accepts the physical diversity of God's creation. Another verse, verse 48 from chapter 5 of the Quran, states, addressing the diversity of humanity, and I quote, For every one of you we have appointed a different law and way of life, and if God had so willed, He could surely have made you all one single community. But He willed it otherwise in order to test you by means of what He has given you. Hasten then in doing good works. To God you all must return, and then He will make you truly understand all that about which you were inclined to differ. End of quote. These verses are crucial proof texts that are invoked by Muslims today to indicate divine sanction of pluralism and to mandate tolerance of difference within God's creation. This is not a contradiction. The Islamic worldview has often been described as based on diversity within unity. Within the larger community of human beings who are religiously equal before the divine being, linguistic, ethnic, cultural, and religious differences are embraced as part of God's mercy. The Quran forbids compulsion in religion, chapter 2, verse 256. It asserts, rather, that all righteous believers will receive their reward from God, as in the famous verse from chapter 2, verse 62, which states unambiguously, and I quote, Those who believe, those who are Jews and Christians and Sabians, whoever believes in God and the last day and does right, surely their reward is with their Lord, and there shall no fear come upon them, neither shall they grieve. End of quote. Another verse, chapter 29, verse 46, counsels Muslims to say to the people of the book, which is the name given to Jews and Christians, and I quote, We believe in the revelation which has come down to us, and in that which came down to you. Our God and your God is one, and it is to him that we submit. End of quote. According to the Quranic vision, believers are to come to the aid of one another. whether they be Christians, Jews, or Muslims, and they are to work with one another in enjoining what is right and preventing what is wrong, a basic moral and ethical principle in Islam. This joint venture is stressed clearly in verse 20-40, which declares, and I quote, "If God had not restrained some people by means of others, monasteries, churches, synagogues, and mosques, where God's name is mentioned frequently, would have been destroyed." End of quote. The Quran's ecumenical call to action in defense of all houses of worship points the way for voices of faith from different traditions to mingle together in support of a moral and just world order in which we all equally have a stake. This verse should remind certain Muslims today who practice exclusivism in the name of Islam that our fellowship, according to the Quran itself, does not extend only to members of our own faith tradition, but to all believers of diverse faith traditions. With regard to gender relations, the Quran asserts the absolute spiritual and religious equality of men and women in Islam. The gender-inclusive language of the Quran makes this very clear. For example, verse 35 of chapter 33 states this very clearly, and I quote, "Those who fear God among males and females, those who give in charity among males and females, those who fast among males and females, those who remember God often among males and females, God has prepared for them forgiveness and a great reward." End of quote. This basic principle of egalitarianism in Islam translated into greater legal and social rights for women. Women are allowed to contract marriages and initiate divorce in specific circumstances, to have access particularly to religious education, to inherit and hold property in their own names, something that was denied to them in pre-Islamic society, in which only men could inherit and own property. But in a verse that is often taken out of context, it's from chapter 4, verse 36, the Quran states that men have been placed in charge of women because men provide for them financially. This verse has been traditionally understood in the context of a patriarchal society to indicate a more privileged social status for men vis-à-vis women. Egalitarian Muslims, however, tend to argue that according to this verse, men's advantage over women is a functional one, not an inherent one. In other words, men are not superior to women by virtue of being men, but because of the economic functions that they perform in society. In modern times, as women become increasingly economically self-sufficient, this basis for assigning men to a superior social position would no longer seem to apply. With regard to clothing, one often hears and reads in the media that women are required by Islamic law to cover themselves from head to toe, and this is meant to signal their inferior status in society. Although the tradition of veiling started quite early in Muslim societies, there is nothing in the Quran that specifically calls for women to cover their heads. Remember that this is in contrast to the New Testament, which advocates in 1 Corinthians that women should cover their hair when praying. The Quran advocates modest clothes for both men and women, but does not explicitly state what such modest attire should consist of. Veiling, we must remember, was common among both Byzantine Christian and Persian women of the upper classes before the rise of Islam in the 7th century of the Common Era. When Muslims conquered lands belonging to the Byzantines and Persians, the practice of veiling became adopted by Muslim women, also as a marker of higher social status and privacy. One must remember that both men and women in many different cultures and societies, especially gentlemen and gentlewomen, habitually wore some kind of head covering. In pre-modern societies until the 20th century, for example, top hats, pillbox hats, wimples, fezes, hijabs, kafias, what have you. Only two Muslim countries require women to cover their heads today, Iran and Saudi Arabia. In the remaining 50-odd Muslim-majority countries today, veiling remains a matter of choice for women. Many highly educated, professional women who hold public offices and cabinet positions, etc., choose to cover their hair, and many don't. The modern headscarf is therefore increasingly a sign of a woman's independence and agency, a symbol usually of her desire to turn her back on materialism and consumerism, the rejection of society's objectification of her body, and a public symbol of her religiosity and a desire to serve God. The reasons are often very personal and varied. Chapter 2. Rights and Responsibilities. Discussion of human dignity inevitably leads us to talk about the rights and responsibilities that inhere in the individual by virtue of being human and the best of God's creation. Medieval Muslim jurists came to hold that five essential rights were guaranteed by Islamic law to the individual, and these are, firstly, the right to life. Every person has the right to protection of his or her life. No harm should befall an individual unless he or she takes a person's life in vain or represents a threat to the security and well-being of other people and to the state. The Quran thus declares in chapter 5, verse 32, and I quote, "If anyone kills a person for any reason other than for the killing of a person or for sowing corruption in the land, it will be as if he had killed the whole of mankind." The second right is the right to protection of property. The same sanctity of life applies to one's property and belongings. A person's property cannot be confiscated without legally valid reasons. Thirdly, right to protection of honor. No person has the right to violate the honor and integrity of another person, even by a slanderous word. Fourthly, the right to practice one's religion. In addition to protection of life, honor, and property, Islam protects the individual's right to practice one's religion free of coercion and interference by the state. The fifth right is protection of one's intellect. This sounds rather awkward in English translation. What this concept points to is essentially that people should enjoy freedom of conscience and freedom of expression to the extent that such freedoms do not encroach on the rights of others. Scholars today tend to regard these rights as equivalent to the fundamental rights of freedom of speech and freedom of religion guaranteed by modern constitutional law. But rights, of course, have to be coupled with responsibilities. As social beings, we have particular responsibilities to fulfill in regard to our fellow human beings, our loved ones, and to strangers. High on the list of an individual's moral and social responsibilities is the preservation of family ties and of kinship in general. The Quran lays great emphasis on the preservation of family ties and kinship. In the Islamic vision of social life, the family is the basic unit of society within which men and women are assigned mutually complementary roles. Traditionally speaking, men are entrusted with financial support and maintenance of the family. Women are entrusted with the rearing of children and the well-being of the family, as in chapter 2, verse 233 in the Quran, where it states, "Mothers shall suckle their children for 2 full years. For such as desire to fulfill the suckling, it is for the father to provide for them and clothe them honorably." Obedience to parents and showing respect and kindness towards them are also emphasized in the Quran. The Quran counsels the believers to show particular compassion for parents when they are old, and not to speak even a single word of reproach towards them. Muslims are also instructed to leave a portion of their wealth to their parents, if they should outlive him, and to their relatives. This is described as an obligation on the God-fearing. Also, in verse 241 of the second chapter, the believers are asked to make provision for their wives upon death. One cannot sever ties of kinship, even when one is hurt by one's relatives. The Quran rather commands the believers to forgive and to continue to support them. The Quran counsels in chapter 22, verse 24, "Let not those who are wealthy refrain from giving to charity to relatives and to the poor and to those who emigrate for the sake of God, but let them pardon and forgive. Do you not wish that God should forgive you? God is all forgiving, all compassionate." End of quote. Other moral precepts and matters of social etiquette outlined in the Quran encourage believers to greet one another respectfully, wishing each other peace. Let's not forget that Islam not only means submission to God, but is also related to the word for peace, salam, in Arabic. There are several hadiths which exhort Muslims to be particularly concerned about their neighbors and their welfare, regardless of their religion. The Prophet Muhammad taught that a neighbor is not just the one next door, but includes all those up to 7 doors away, effectively a whole neighborhood. This concern for our neighbors can take many forms. It means to ensure that our neighbors have the basic necessities. In one well-known hadith, the Prophet declares that one whose neighbor goes to bed hungry at night is not a believer. Being neighborly means that Muslims should wish for their neighbors what they wish for themselves, the golden rule. It means sharing their happiness and sorrow. Further, it means not to spy on them and respect their privacy, not to gossip about them, and not to harm them in any way. This might even mean to keep areas of common use, such as apartment building entrances, streets, and sidewalks, clean and accessible. The Prophet Muhammad was once informed of a woman who prayed and fasted much and gave alms generously, but whose neighbors complained of her abusive tongue. He remarked that she would be punished for that. When he was informed of another woman who did not perform all these extra acts of worship, but whose neighbors were happy with her, he commented that she would see her reward in paradise. Thus we see the importance of being good to our neighbors, both in actions and words. The old, the very young, and the sick are also entitled to our special attention and care. There are many hadiths which urge believers to show respect for the elderly and affection towards children. Muslims are urged to visit the sick and spend time with them. With regard to business ethics, fairness in commercial transactions is prescribed. Usury, the charging of interest at an exorbitant rate, is forbidden in chapter 2, verse 279. Above all, believers are exhorted to deal kindly, honestly, and patiently with one another at all times, and to give each other good counsel and confer with one another in matters of mutual concern. Muslims have a special responsibility towards the poor. Islam calls for mutual solidarity between the members of society in order to ensure a good life and safety from poverty and need. God describes the righteous in the Quran as those in whose wealth there is a share set aside for the beggar who asks and for the deprived. The Quran, in chapter 2, verse 177, states, and I quote, "It is not righteousness that you turn your faces toward the east or west, but it is righteousness to believe in God and the last day and the angels and the book and the messengers, to spend of your substance out of love for him, for your kin, for orphans, for the needy, the wayfarer, for those who ask, and for the ransom of slaves." End of quote. This verse emphasizes that mechanical observance of certain religious duties does not constitute righteousness. Rather, the practice of charity towards all, proceeding out of faith in and love for God constitutes true righteousness. One of the five pillars of Islam is charity, or almsgiving, known in Arabic as zakat. The word zakat means purification, giving up a portion of one's wealth in excess of what is needed for sustenance purifies and legalizes the rest of one's wealth, so that it may then be used lawfully by the almsgiver. This yearly alms is obligatory on those who are wealthy and allows wealth to be redistributed from the rich to the poor. Zakat, in spirit, is an act of worship, while in its external form it is the carrying out of a social service. It is an institution that makes concern for the poor a permanent and compulsory duty. Fasting during the month of Ramadan, which requires giving up eating and drinking during daylight hours, also creates a sense of compassion for those who are less fortunate than us. By voluntarily suffering the same pangs of hunger as the poor who have no choice in this matter, we are reminded of their suffering and encouraged to provide for their needs. Voluntary giving of alms, in addition to the obligatory zakat, is strongly encouraged in Islam. The best charity is to satisfy a hungry person, said the Prophet. He also said that the wealth of a worshipper never decreases on account of almsgiving. In a highly evocative passage, the Quran in chapter 2, verse 261, states that the likeness of those who spend their wealth for the sake of God is as the likeness of a grain that sprouts 7 ears. In each ear may be found 100 grains. Indeed, God multiplies for whom he will. End of quote. This verse points to the manifold spiritual benefits resulting from a single act of charity. Islamic ethical literature also emphasizes that charity does not consist only of almsgiving. One may practice charity by greeting one's fellow human being with a smiling face, by speaking kindly to a stranger or a loved one, by refraining from speaking ill of someone or speaking sharply to someone. In other words, by behaving in an upright and congenial manner and by spreading good cheer from which everyone benefits, one carries out an essential act of charity. In connection with human responsibilities, we should note that the Quran states that humans were appointed as God's vicegerents or representatives on earth. Chapter 2, verses 28 through 29 says, and I quote, "And when your Lord said to the angels, 'I am setting in the earth a vicegerent,' they said, 'What, will you set therein one who will do corruption there and shed blood, while we proclaim your praise and call you holy?' He said, 'Assuredly, I know what you know not.' And he taught Adam the names, all of them." End of quote. What is the significance of this verse? It means that humans, out of all creation, enjoy a unique relationship with God, for God gave us knowledge that no other creature possesses. As God's representatives in this world, humans are bound to implement the divine law, known in Arabic as the Sharia. This view is at the root of Islamic ethics. A large measure of this responsibility is to guarantee moral and social order by upholding good and forbidding evil. This is a phrase that occurs frequently in the Quran and in Islamic ethical literature. It is fair to say that all of the ethical teaching in Islam boils down to this one golden rule: commanding and supporting good and forbidding the doing of wrong. When the forces of evil threaten to overcome the forces of good, one must resist by a variety of means. One hadith says that the believer must strive to resist wrong with the heart, the tongue, and the hand, allowing for quietest resistance, verbal resistance, and physical resistance to evil. But the message is clear: injustice must be resisted, otherwise one would violate God's order on earth and be guilty of a serious abdication of moral responsibility. Justice, tempered by mercy, is a moral desideratum in Islamic thought. Justice and mercy are in fact two qualities most associated with the essence of Islam, the essence of what it means to be a Muslim, and the essence of an Islamic society or community. These two qualities are constantly emphasized throughout the Quran. All the chapters in the Quran, except one, begin with the same phrase, "In the name of God, the Merciful, the Compassionate." God's justice, which is part of His infinite mercy, receives equal emphasis. Among the 99 names in Arabic to describe God's attributes is the Just. The cultivation of these two attributes, justice and mercy, is also incumbent upon humans as God's representatives and stewards on earth. In exacting justice, the lex talionis, which occurs in the Old Testament, also finds reflection in the Quran. Lex talionis is the principle or law according to which punishment meted out corresponds in degree and kind to the offense committed, expressed in the principle an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, etc. However, the Quran also states that forgiveness of injury done to oneself is more honorable. Verse 174 of the second chapter states, "O believers, if a man is pardoned anything by his brother, let it be done honorably, and let the payment be with kindliness. This is a concession granted you by your Lord, and a mercy." End of quote. Chapter 3. Misconceptions of Jihad. The Quranic injunction to always enjoin what is good and resist what is evil has primarily a spiritual and social reformist meaning for the individual. According to this injunction, the individual's primary duty is to fight against one's inner base desires and to struggle to achieve what is good and righteous in one's community and the world. The Quran reminds the faithful in chapter 13, verse 11, "Indeed, God does not change people's circumstances unless they change what is in themselves." All meaningful progress in the spiritual and social sense begins with the individual and his or her mastery over the carnal self. In Islamic ethical literature, this internal personal campaign against the temptations and pettiness that sometimes beset us has been called the greater struggle or the greater jihad. So there you have it, a word that almost inevitably today is coupled with Islam and Muslims, and more often than not, in a negative way. The Arabic word jihad means effort, struggle, striving in the broadest sense. What I just referred to is the internal and spiritual jihad. Struggling to earn a living is also a part of jihad. Striving to get an education, for example, by taking this course is jihad. Fighting poverty and instituting welfare programs, all these activities are part of jihad. Anything that is part of the basic human enterprise of bettering oneself and one's surroundings and contributing to the welfare of one's fellow human being is jihad. There is also the physical military jihad, which may be required in certain circumstances. It is this last meaning which has become most frequently associated with the term jihad in popular discourse today. One should also be aware that jihad does not mean holy war, as is often carelessly translated. The Quran does not permit the spread of Islam by force. A holy war implies the forcible conversion of non-believers, a concept doctrinally unacceptable in Islam. With regard to jihad in the sense of armed combat, the Quran instructs the believers to, and I quote, "Fight in the way of God with those who fight you, but aggress not. God loves not the aggressors." The Quran also states in chapter 8, verse 61, "But if the enemy inclines towards peace, you should also incline towards peace." Islam is not unique, of course, in permitting armed combat in self-defense during specific circumstances. The Bible, for example, relates the stories of Moses, Joshua, Saul, and David, who were urged to take up arms when necessary against those who had defied God, and to fight in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, as occurs in 1 Samuel 17:45. The taking of human life is such an enormity that even during a legitimate war, certain ethical restraints must be observed according to Islamic law. Thus, during the military jihad, Muslim combatants are required to follow a very strict and honorable protocol of not attacking civilians on the opposite side. Women, children, and elderly men, among others who do not bear arms, may not be attacked. Muslim soldiers may also not cause reckless destruction of property or of crops and trees, nor engage in looting and arson. There are correspondences between the concept of the physical jihad in Islam and that of just war in the Christian tradition. In legitimate self-defense and as a last resort, both concepts allow believers to engage in armed combat against their intractable enemies. But isn't it true, one may ask at this point, that as we have heard in the media, and as extremist, militant Muslims are quoted as saying, that Islam requires Muslims to keep fighting against non-Muslims until they convert or until they are wiped out? This belief represents a terrible slander against Islam, unfortunately propagated by some Muslims themselves. First of all, to set the record straight, as I've already pointed out, the Quran has a high regard for all righteous believers and does not consider monotheistic Jews or Christians to be unbelievers or infidels. Jews and Christians are described respectfully in the Quran as people of the book, that is, people with a divinely revealed scripture in which Muslims must also have faith. In one passage, the Quran describes righteous Jews and Christians as constituting a moderate community, just as righteous Muslims constitute a moderate community. In another Quranic passage, righteous Jews and Christians are described as constituting an upright community because of their humility and prayerfulness. Muslim receptivity to people from the Abrahamic faith traditions, who are fellow monotheists and share to a considerable extent a similar scriptural and prophetic tradition, is understandable. It is worthy of note that as Muslims encountered over time those outside the monotheistic Abrahamic tradition, the Quranic principle of non-coercion in faith was also generally extended to them. Thus the Zoroastrians of Persia and the Hindus of India came to be accorded the status of protected people by their Muslim rulers, a status traditionally reserved for Jews and Christians. This meant that in return for their loyalty to the state and payment of their taxes, they too could continue to practice their religion and their way of life. By the standards of the pre-modern age, the elastic concept of the people of the book allowed multiple religious communities to coexist, often peacefully, for stretches of time under various Muslim rulers. The rubric Islamic civilization masks the fact that at its zenith it was in fact quite a hybrid and cosmopolitan civilization, whose members were of different ethnic, religious, and cultural backgrounds. Only the pagan Arabs, who bitterly persecuted the Prophet Muhammad and his followers in the 7th century simply on account of their faith in the one God, are described in the Quran as unbelievers. And it is only against them that Muslims were finally allowed to take up arms, not because the pagan Arabs were polytheists or idol worshippers, but because they had unjustly tormented the earliest Muslims, driven them out of their homes, and rendered them destitute. It is against this context that we must understand two Quranic verses which are often cited by extremist Muslims to justify their militancy. One such verse is from chapter 9, verse 5, which has been termed the sword verse. It states, and I quote, "And when the sacred months are over, slay the polytheists wherever you find them and take them captive, and besiege them, and lie in wait for them at every conceivable place." Another verse, from chapter 9, verse 29 runs, and I quote, "Fight against those who, despite having been given revelation before, do not believe in God nor in the last day, and do not consider forbidden that which God and his messenger have forbidden, and do not follow the religion of the truth, until they pay the poll tax with willing hand, having been subdued." End of quote. The first of the sword verses, chapter 9, verse 5, with its internal reference to the polytheists who may be fought after the end of the sacred months, applies only to the pagan Arabs during the prophet's time. This is, in fact, how many scholars have understood the verse. The second of the sword verses is seemingly directed in general at the people of the book, that is, Jews and Christians. But a careful reading of the verse clearly indicates that it does not intend all the people of the book, but only those from among them who do not, in contravention of their own laws, believe in God in the last day, and do not forbid wrongdoing. That is, the verse clearly refers to the wrongdoers among Jews and Christians. The Quran, after all, praises righteous Jews and Christians in other verses. For example, in chapter 3, verses 113 through 115, the Quran states, and I quote, "They are not all the same. Among the people of the book are a contingent who stand in prayer, reciting the verses of God at all times of the night while they prostrate. These are they who believe in God in the last day, and enjoin what is right and forbid what is wrong. They hasten to perform good deeds, and they are among the righteous. And whatever they do of good will not be rejected by God, and God knows best who are the God-fearing." End of quote. The Quran, in another verse, chapter 2, verse 193, makes unambiguously clear that should hostile behavior on the part of the enemies of Islam cease, then the reason for engaging them in war also lapses. This verse states, "And fight them on until there is no discord and religion is for God. But if they cease, let there be no hostility except to those who practice oppression." The harshness of the two sword verses is thus considerably mitigated and their general applicability significantly restricted by juxtaposing to them conciliatory verses, such as the ones cited above, and other such verses. Among other such verses is the one that has been characterized as the peace verse. It is from chapter 8, verse 61. "If they incline toward peace, incline you toward it and trust in God. Indeed, he alone is all-hearing, all-knowing." End of quote. And, very important, Quran 68 clearly states, and I quote, "God does not forbid you from being kind and just to those who have neither made war on you on account of your religion nor driven you from your homes. God loves those who are just." These verses make warring against those who oppose the propagation of the message of Islam and consequently resort to persecution of Muslims dependent upon their continuing hostility. Should they refrain from such hostile persecution and sue for peace instead, the Muslims are commanded to respond favorably to their request. Quran 68, in particular, makes it clear that non-Muslims of goodwill and peaceableness cannot be the targets of hostility simply on account of their different religious backgrounds. This is a very powerful message in the Quran, and we must keep this in mind, especially when confronted by extremist statements. What do we call those militant Muslims who violate these fundamental Quranic injunctions and target civilians and destroy lives and property in their quest for political dominion? Well, the Muslim jurists were unanimous in condemning such people as Muharibun in Arabic. In our terminology today, that means terrorists. Muharibun in Arabic are those who carry out haraba. This is the legal term used for illegitimate violence that causes terror among civilian populations. In other words, it is plain and simple terrorism. I, for one, never refer to these militants as jihadists, because that would make me complicit in their annexation of the term jihad to their violent enterprises. Jihad, in its basic sense, expresses the highest striving of humans to fulfill the will of God on earth. One should remember that in Arabic translations of the New Testament, Christ's struggle on earth is referred to as jihad. Sometimes I hear the question from my audience, in this case, since Islam is categorically against terrorism, why don't Muslims condemn it loudly and publicly? The simple answer is, Muslims do it all the time, but these voices are usually not conveyed to the American public by our sensation-seeking media. Why didn't our media report to us right after September 11 that there were candlelight vigils held in many Muslim cities, in Islamabad, in Tehran, in the West Bank, in support of the American people and in condemnation of the terrorists who carried out their dastardly deeds in the name of Islam? Or that Muslim jurists in America and elsewhere declared in public that Americans had the moral right to retaliate against these attacks in justified self-defense? I encourage you to go to a website whose address is the American Muslim, no spaces, theamericanmuslim.org, to find a collection of these statements and petitions in denunciation of terrorist acts carried out by so-called Muslims. Chapter 4, Stewardship and the Common Good. I next want to turn to the notion of stewardship on earth, that is, humans acting as God's custodians on earth. That is a very important Quranic ethical principle and is part of the human struggle, that is, the human jihad, to achieve righteousness and a just order in this world. Closely connected with human stewardship on earth is the notion of a trust, in Arabic, amana. The earth has been bequeathed by God to human stewards as a trust, meaning that they are obligated to live on it, cultivate it, and take care of it as God intended them to do. Such a trust should translate into concern for environmental justice, for example, and for economic justice for all. Our trusteeship of the earth means we should be concerned with whether everyone has equal access to the earth's resources or not. This is also a part of charity. One hadith, or a statement of the Prophet Muhammad, states, "The earth is green and beautiful, and God has appointed you his stewards over it. The whole earth has been created a place of worship, pure and clean. Whoever plants a tree and diligently looks after it until it matures and bears fruit is rewarded. If a Muslim plants a tree or sows a field, and humans and beasts and birds eat from it, all of it is counted as charity on his part." Even in times of war, as I mentioned earlier, Islamic law orders that trees, crops, other vegetation, and animals are to be given the same protection accorded to civilians and all places of worship during armed conflict, all of which would be necessary tools for the eventual restoration of peace. This concern for the environment, which we all share, drives home the message that our salvation is linked to the well-being of our fellow humans. A lack of concern for the well-being of others, that is, for the common good, points to moral and spiritual bankruptcy within ourselves, regardless of how careful we are in observing certain rituals and how diligent we are in personal worship. What do human beings strive on earth for? We strive on earth, that is, we carry out jihad in our lives to promote the common welfare of all human beings. The common good in Islamic ethical thought is termed in Arabic maslaha, which means benefit or utility. It became an important objective in Islamic law since the interpretation of the religious law, the Sharia, and the application of specific legal rulings must be guided by considerations of public welfare and benefit. As historical circumstances change, this very important legal principle of maslaha, of the common good, allows for new appropriate interpretations of the religious law to emerge, which advance the well-being of people. Islam emphasizes the importance of community and communal life for the individual. Moral and ordered communal life is necessary for the proper flourishing of the human individual and society. Therefore, good governance is a matter of importance in Islamic ethics. While the Quran does not prescribe any one specific form of government, it advocates non-autocratic, consultative methods of government and defines several fundamental social and political values, namely justice, mercy, and tolerance. Modernist Muslims today regard a constitutional democracy that protects the rights of the individual as having the greatest potential for promoting the Quranic values of consultation and accountability. These Muslims claim that a democratic form of government can grant all humans the same political rights, thus expressing the special status of humans in God's creation, and allowing humankind to assume its charge as responsible custodians of the earth. Muslims point to the example of the second caliph, or successor after the death of the prophet, known as Amr ibn Khattab. Amr, the second caliph, set up a shura, or an electoral council, which selected the next leader of the community. Shura, which in its basic sense means consultation, is thus regarded by many Muslims as the forerunner of today's modern forms of democratic governance. And finally, I want to broach the topic of peacemaking. The promotion of peace is also a fundamental concern of Islam, which proceeds out of a concern for this general welfare of humankind. The biblical counsel, "Love thy neighbor," is echoed in the Quran's exhortation to humankind to come to know one another, as in the verse I cited earlier from chapter 49, verse 13, which states, "O humankind, we have created you from a male and a female, and made you into nations and tribes, that you might get to know one another. The noblest of you in God's sight is the one who is most righteous." The medieval Muslim exegete, known as Al-Dabaryu, he died in the early 10th century, explains this verse as emphasizing that only on the basis of piety may we distinguish between human beings, not on the basis of social status, not on the basis of descent or nobility of birth. He quotes a hadith in this context in which the Prophet Muhammad relates that all humans were descended from Adam and Eve. Indeed, the Prophet asserts, "God will not question you regarding your pedigree and tribal affiliation on the Day of Judgment, for only the most righteous is the noblest before God." End of quote. You have to realize that this was a pretty radical notion in 7th century Arabia, which until the coming of Islam regarded only those who were high-born and from a noble tribe as amounting to something. When we reflect on the significance of this verse in our own period, we find in this verse a clear scriptural mandate for respecting the differences we encounter among peoples. This verse urges the believer to accept differences in national and ethnic origins as divinely ordained, and to be concerned only with the larger common issues of morality and ethics. The last part of this Quranic verse states that all will return to God, and it is He who will make you truly understand all that on which you were accustomed to differ. Thus, it is not for human beings to decide for themselves who is right and who is wrong as far as theological issues are concerned, since that leads to dissension and strife. It should be left to God alone to decide when they return to Him. Human beings should only strive with one another in the carrying out of good deeds. This is a powerful Quranic notion which we may regard as being in keeping with the spirit of our own pluralist age. This non-judgmental attitude is also echoed in the Bible in Matthew 7:3, where humans are exhorted to consider the log in our own eye before worrying about the speck in another's. On the basis of such shared values and ethical principles, Muslims and other people of faith and goodwill may indeed find common ground and common purpose in today's divided world.